This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled The Influence of the Dead on Destiny. This is lecture 5, entitled The Members of the Human Being and the Periods of Life, given in Dornach on December 15, 1917. If we wish to understand what lies at the foundation of the two impulses that penetrate so deeply into human life, so-called free will and so-called necessity, then we must add still other thoughts to the various ideas we have already discussed. I will do this today, so that tomorrow we can draw our considerations to a conclusion regarding the concepts of free will and necessity in the social, ethical, moral, and historical processes of human life. In discussing such things, it becomes increasingly evident that people, especially modern people, strive to embrace the highest, most important and significant things with the simplest concepts and thoughts. I have often mentioned that one must know certain things to understand a clock. Someone who has not the slightest idea of how the wheels work together, for example, will not be able to explain the details of how a clock works. Yet we wish to be competent judges of free will and necessity in all situations of life without having learned any fundamentals about these things. We prefer to remain ignorant about the most important and essential things, which can only be understood if we consider their whole relationship to human nature, and we wish to know and judge everything imaginable of our own accord. This is a particular desire of our times. When we say that the human being is a complicated being, organized in manifold ways, a being that penetrates deeply both into the physical plane and the spiritual world, then people often object that such things are dry and intellectual, and that the most important and essential things must be grasped in quite another way. The world will have to learn, perhaps the present catastrophic events are already teaching us a little, how much lies hidden in us and in our relationship with the course of world development. For years we have emphasized that we can differentiate roughly in human beings their physical nature or physical body, the etheric body or the body of formative forces, as I have called it, the astral body or the soul, and the actual capital I. We have emphasized recently, from the most varied points of view, that in reality, in our ordinary day-waking consciousness, between waking and sleeping, we have only partial knowledge of the impressions given through our senses and of our thoughts. But dream and sleep overlap into the world of waking life. We dream away the real content of our feeling life and sleep through the real content of our life of the will. Through our feelings and through the contents of our will, we dive into the world in which we live together with the dead, among the beings of the higher hierarchies, the angeloi, archangeloi, archai, and so on. As soon as we live in a feeling, and we live constantly in feelings, everything in the kingdom of the dead lives with us in this sphere, or in the realm of feeling. Now something else must be added to this. In the life of ordinary waking consciousness, we speak of our I. However, we can only speak of this I in a very unreal sense, as far as our ordinary waking consciousness is concerned. For what is the real nature and being of this I? Normal waking consciousness cannot understand this. When clairvoyant consciousness penetrates into the true being of the I, it will find that it has a will-like nature. What we have in everyday consciousness is only an idea of the I. And this is why it is so easy for experimental psychologists to deny this I, even though this denial is really nonsense. These scientists and psychologists say that the I develops gradually and that human beings acquire this I in the course of their individual development. Human beings do not acquire the I itself in this way, but only the idea of the I. It is easy to deny the I because for everyday consciousness it is merely a thought, a reflection of the true, genuine I. The real I lives in the same sphere as the true reality of our will. And what we call our astral body, what we designate as the actual soul life, lives in the same sphere as our life of feelings. If you bear in mind the things we have thus considered, you will see that we dive with our eye and our astral body into the same region that we share with the dead. When we penetrate clairvoyantly into our true eye, we are also among both the eyes of the dead and the eyes of the so-called living. We must understand such things quite clearly in order to grasp how much we live with our everyday consciousness in the so-called world of appearance, in Maya. We are consciously awake in the world of our senses and in the world of our thoughts. However, the sense impulses give us only the physical world of nature, and our thoughts give us only what is in us and corresponds to our own nature between birth and death. Our eternal nature remains in the world we share with the dead. When we incarnate into life on the physical plane, our eternal self truly remains in the world where the dead live. In order to understand these things fully, we must grasp thoughts that are not so easy to digest. But these things must be said because they are true. We must exert ourselves to think them through. We do not have such thoughts in the course of our everyday waking consciousness. We know in this waking consciousness only what takes place in space and time, and we want to be satisfied with this. Often we human beings become ill because we try to imagine the contents of the spiritual world spatially, even though as something nebulous or misty. We want to think about it spatially, with souls flying about in space and so on. We must go beyond the ideas of space and time to more complicated ideas, if we really want to penetrate into these things. Today I would like to draw your attention to something that is very important for the understanding of the whole of human life. Let us bear in mind once more the fact that, roughly speaking, we possess this fourfold nature: the physical body, the body of formative forces or etheric body, the astral body, and the eye. Now, when someone asks from the standpoint of ordinary waking consciousness how old a person is, people answer by giving the person's age, let us say 35, and believe that they have said something serious. In stating that a certain person is 35 years old, they have indeed said something of importance for the physical plane and for ordinary waking consciousness. However, for the spiritual world, in other words, for the etheric being of the human being, this states only a part of the reality. When you say that you are 35 years old, you only say this in regard to your physical body. To be correct, you must say that your physical body is 35 years old, but these words express nothing at all about the etheric body or the other members of the human being. For it is an illusion, indeed a fantasy, to think that your eye, for instance, is 35 years old when your physical body is 35 years old. Here we must bear in mind different rates of speed in the development of the various members of the human being. The following figures will make you realize this. We say that a particular human being is 7 years old. This only means that his or her physical body has reached the age of 7 years. The etheric body is not yet 7 years old, for the body of formative forces does not maintain the same speed as the physical body. Because we imagine time as one continuous stream, we are not aware of such things, and so we cannot understand that different things maintain different speeds within the course of time. This physical body that is 7 years old has developed according to a certain speed. The etheric body develops more slowly, the astral body still more slowly, and slowest of all is the eye. The etheric body is only 5 years old and 3 months old when the physical body is 7 years old, because it develops more slowly. The astral body is 3 years and 6 months old, and the eye 1 year and 9 months. Let me read that part again. The etheric body, when the physical body is 7 years old, the etheric body is only 5 years and 3 months old when the physical body is 7 years old, because it develops more slowly. The astral body is 3 years and 6 months old, and the eye 1 year and 9 months. On the physical plane, this I develops at a slower pace. We live in the same slower pace in our life with the dead. Why do we not grasp what takes place in the stream of the experiences of the dead? Because we do not accustom ourselves to slowing down when we are holding the dead inwardly in our thoughts and feelings where they live. Hence, if our physical body is 28 years old, then our I is only 7 years old. Our I, which is the essential part of our being, thus maintains a much slower pace in the course of development than the physical body. The difficulty consists in the fact that we generally consider speed or velocities merely as outer velocities. When things move beside one another, we say that one thing moves more quickly and the other one more slowly, because we use time as a comparison. But here, the speed within time is different. Without this insight into the fact that the different members of the human being have different speeds in their development, it is impossible to grasp the connection with the true, deeper being of the human being. From this you will see how, in everyday consciousness, people simply throw together entirely different things contained in human nature. Human beings consist of this fourfold being, and the four members of this being are so different from one another that they even have different ages. However, people fall under a great illusion by applying the physical body to everything. They say something with absolutely no meaning whatever for the spiritual world when they say that their I is 28 years old at the same time as their physical body. We must realize that the four members of the human being must be reckoned according to four entirely different measurements of time. For the I, a year is simply four times as long as for the physical body. This could be shown pictorially if we wanted to project this onto the physical plane. For instance, while a human being may grow normally and become 28 years old, a child might grow more slowly and after 28 years be like a child of 7. Thus the whole matter appears at first like an abstract truth, but it is a fundamental reality in the human being. Just consider that our I is the bearer of what we call our understanding or our self-conscious thinking. When our understanding and our conscious thinking are within our I, then this understanding and conscious thinking are actually much younger than we are according to our physical body. This reveals, however, that when a human being of 28 seems to have understanding that has developed to the age of 28, only 1/4 of this understanding is really his or her own. It cannot be otherwise. If we have a certain amount of understanding at 28, only 1/4 of this is our own. The rest belongs to the universal world, to the world in which we are submerged through our astral body, etheric body, and physical body. Yet we know something of these bodies directly only through ideas and sense perceptions, in other words, within the I. This means that during our development as human beings, between birth and death, we are only a mere semblance of a reality. We make the impression of being 4 times as clever as we really are. All we possess, in addition to this 1/4, we owe to what holds sway in the historical, social, and moral work within the world where we dream and sleep. Dream and sleep impulses, which we have in common with the universe, seethe up above the horizon of our being, fructify this 1/4 part of our understanding and soul, and make it 4 times as strong as it really is. Here is the point where illusion arises concerning human freedom. The human being is indeed a free being. However, only the real human being is free. Only the 1/4 part that I just described is a free being. Other beings play into the remaining 3/4. Therefore, these parts cannot be free. From this arises the delusion regarding freedom that causes us to continually ask if human beings are free or not. They are free when the idea of freedom is connected with that one-fourth of their being. If human beings wish to have this freedom as an impulse of their own, they must develop this one-fourth part in a correspondingly independent way. In ordinary life, this one-fourth part cannot assert itself, simply because it is overpowered by the other three-fourths. Our desires, appetites, emotions, and passions are active in the remaining three-fourths. These slay our freedom, for what is contained in the universe in the form of impulses works through these desires, emotions, and passions. Now the question arises, how can we make this one-fourth of our soul life really free? We must relate this one-fourth with what is independent of the remaining three-fourths. I have tried to answer this question philosophically in my title, Intuitive Thinking as a Spiritual Path, also known as the Philosophy of Freedom, by attempting to show how human beings can only be free within themselves when they place their actions entirely under the influence of pure thinking, meaning when they transform impulses of pure thought into impulses of action that are not in any way dependent upon the outer world for their development. For whatever is developed out of the outer world does not allow us to be free. Only what develops in our thinking independently of the outer world as the motive of our actions lets us realize freedom. Where do such motives come from, if they do not come from the outer world? They come out of the spiritual world. Human beings need not be clairvoyantly conscious, in every situation of life, of how these impulses come from the spiritual world. They can, nevertheless, be within them all the same. But they will necessarily conceive these impulses in a somewhat different way than they are in reality. When we rise in clairvoyant consciousness to the first stage of the spiritual world, we come to the imaginative world. The second stage is the world of inspiration, as you know. The third stage, the world of intuition. Instead of allowing the impulses of our will or actions to rise out of our physical, astral, and etheric bodies, we can receive them as imaginations, behind which stand inspirations and intuitions. That is, if we receive no impulses from our bodies, but only from the spiritual world. The following does not need to be experienced through conscious clairvoyant perception. Quote, "Now I will something, and behind this will stand intuition, inspiration, and imagination." Close quote. Instead, the result of this appears as an idea, as a pure thought, and has the appearance of an idea created in the imagination. Because this is so, because such an idea lying at the foundation of free actions must appear to everyday consciousness as an idea created out of imagination, I called it moral imagination in my title Intuitive Thinking as a Spiritual Path. What then is this moral imagination? This moral imagination is the opposite of a mirrored reflection. What lies spread out around us as the outer physical reality is a mirrored reflection. Physical reality sends us reflections of things. We cannot see through the tableau of moral imagination, so things appear to us as fantasy or imagination. Behind them, however, stand the real active impulses, imagination, inspiration, and intuition. When we do not know that these impulses are active, but only receive what they bring about into our ordinary consciousness, it then looks like a fantasy. And these results of moral imagination, these incentives to action that do not lie in desires, passions, and emotions, are free. But how can we attain moral imagination? If we were to attain clairvoyance, we would come to it consciously. However, we do not need to do that. A human being who is not clairvoyant can also develop moral imagination. All real progress for humanity has always proceeded out of moral imagination, as far as this progress developed within the ethical sphere. The point in question is that we first develop a feeling, then, and then, an enhanced feeling. We shall hear immediately what is meant by enhanced feeling, that we are not merely here on this earth to accomplish things concerning us personally or individually, but also to accomplish things that allow the will of the time spirits to be realized. It appears as if we were implying something quite special when we say that we must accomplish the will of the time spirits. But a time will come when we will understand this much better than now, and a time will come when the contents of human teaching will be different. At present, only ideas dealing with nature are conveyed, even to the most educated people. What is imparted to people regarding ethical and social life is, in most cases, an unreal schematic abstraction. In this connection, we have not yet attained what earlier ages possessed. Only with great difficulty can modern people think themselves into earlier times. Earlier times possessed myths connected with the vital life of the people. These myths penetrated into poetry, art, and into all manner of things. With what were these myths concerned? In Greece, one spoke of Oedipus, Hercules, and other heroes worthy of emulation. They were the first to do exemplary deeds, and everyone wished to follow in their footsteps. The thread of imagination, thought, and feeling led backward, so that people felt at one with those long dead. What went out as impulse from those who had died was told in myths, and human beings lived in experiencing and becoming one with the impulses of these myths. Something similar must again be created, and will be created, when the impulses of spiritual science are rightly understood. Except that in the future, souls will gaze forward much more than backward. Public teaching must consist of what binds human beings together with current earthly development, and above all with the impulses of the time spirit. The corresponding being from the hierarchy of the Archai, before whom stand the so-called dead as well as the living, as I have said previously. People will learn in the public teaching of the future the meaning of such a period of culture as the one that began in the 15th century, closing the Greco-Roman period. In our current fifth post-Atlantean period, people will learn to know the real intentions of the general cosmos. They will take up the spiritual impulses of our time, and they will know that these impulses must be manifested between the 15th century and one of the centuries of a coming millennium. And they will know that we belong to our cultural period in such a way that the impulses of the existing age stream through us. In the future, even children, as they learn to name the flowers and the stars, they do this less today, but it is at least something outwardly real. We'll learn to take up the real spiritual impulses of the period. First, they must be educated to do this. What is told as history today must first cease to be called history. In a not-too-distant future, instead of speaking of historical events as they do today, people will speak of the spiritual impulses standing behind historical world development. Impulses that are dreamt by human beings. These are the spiritual impulses that call us to freedom and make us free, because they raise us to the world from which intuition, inspiration, and imagination come. What happens outwardly on the physical plane, constituting outer history, I have explained this even in public lectures, loses its meaning as soon as it is in the past. In reality, it does not justify our saying that the former event is always the cause of the following one. There is nothing more senseless than to recount history by describing, for instance, the deeds of Napoleon at the beginning of the 19th century, and then assuming that the events after Napoleon's exile are the consequence of Napoleon's actions. Nothing is more senseless than this. For what one can tell about Napoleon signifies exactly the same for reality as the description of a human corpse 3 days after death signifies for the dead person's life. What is now called history is a cadaver event, in quotes, compared with reality, even though this cadaver event has a great importance in the minds of many people. What happens outwardly becomes reality only when its development out of spiritual impulses is revealed. Then it will be seen clearly that a human being's deeds, for example, in a certain decade of a certain century, are the consequence of what he or she experienced before entering into incarnation on earth. Their deeds are in no sense the consequence of events occurring in the course of decades of physical experience on earth. Anthroposophical spiritual science will have to deepen and fructify the sphere of history, especially in regard to historical, social, and moral life. When this knowledge of spiritual impulses has become one of the essential demands of our time, it will then correspond to the living reality of the myths in ancient times. This knowledge will permeate human beings with impulses leading them to deeds and actions that will make them free. These things must first be understood. Then, when this understanding spreads over an ever wider sphere, it will indeed influence real life. But these considerations will also show you something else. You will realize that the impulses of feeling and will, with which we are in the same sphere of life as the so-called dead, are a higher and more intensive reality than the one we know in our waking consciousness as ideas and sense impressions. For this reason, what I just described as a demand of our age, which must become an object of public teaching, can only be truly fruitful when it is not merely grasped with the understanding, but when it goes over into the impulses of feeling and will. This can only come about when spiritual science is really seen as not simply a theory, but true reality. Spiritual science is easily looked upon merely as a teaching or theory, but in fact spiritual science is truly a quote-unquote living word. Spiritual science is the revelation from the world we share with the higher hierarchies and with the so-called dead. Those who really understand it know that the soul music of the spiritual world resounds forth in spiritual science. What we read, not from dead letters, but from the real happenings in the spiritual world, can indeed permeate our feeling with fervent life when we grasp spiritual science as something speaking to our inner being from the spiritual world. I have emphasized at different times how the matter stands when I described how, on the one hand, since 1879, spiritual life can stream down to the physical plane in an entirely new way, and how, on the other hand, it must indeed face its opponents in the spirits of darkness. Everything must still be achieved in connection with the content of spiritual science, really entering our feeling and will. And this can be achieved only when certain things change thoroughly, those things with which modern humanity has reached a cultural dead-end street. We must also let it sink in that historical development progresses in such a way that on the one hand the events of history may be compared to a growing tree, but when the leaves have grown as far as the periphery, the tree ceases to grow and the dying process begins. It is the same with historical events. Let us stay with the picture I have used here before. A definitive group of historical events may have their roots in the last third of the 18th century. I shall speak of this more clearly tomorrow. Other influences were added to these in the course of the 19th century and so on. But you see, these historical events expand and reach their extreme boundaries. There is a drawing. In this case, the boundary is not the same as in the case of a tree or a plant that does not grow beyond its periphery. Here a new root of historical events must begin. For decades already we have been living in a time when such new historical events must spring out of direct intuition. But in the historical life of human beings, illusion can also spread easily concerning these things. To be sure, you can watch the growth of a plant that grows according to its inner laws, until it reaches a certain periphery and cannot grow beyond it. Yet now you can call forth an illusion by attaching wires, hanging paper leaves on them, and giving yourself the illusion that the plant continues to grow up to this point. Such wires do indeed exist where historical events are concerned. While historical events should long ago have adopted another course, such wires are there instead. Except that in historical development these wires are human prejudices and human indolence, which continue to maintain on dead wires what has died long ago. Certain people place themselves at the ends of these dead wires, in other words, at the outermost ends of human prejudice, and these people are often considered true historical personalities. And people do not realize how much these personalities sit on the wires of human prejudice. One of the most important tasks of the present is to begin somewhat to judge how many personalities who are looked upon as great individualities are in reality merely hanging on the wires of human prejudice. The end of Lecture 5.